You're listening to the Hub City Church podcast. To learn more about Hub City Church, including our gathering times, you can check out our website at albanyhubcity.com.
Morning. Nobody wanted front row, huh? Oh man, all right. I'm just alone up here, no big deal. Well, great to see you guys. Yeah, I hope you're just, I just really pray and hope that we're just steeped in Matthew, that like there's just something about this book that's not just like, oh, I'm curious what we'll think about on Sunday or whatever, but just this book has really come alive. I remember when we went through John, what was it, about 6 years it took us or so to go through? Like 2.5 years, I think, and it just instantly became, oh man, this is the best book ever, and like I could just eat, you know, everything about it. And then we did Mark, I think, if I get the timeline right, and that became like, oh man, this is it, this is the one, you know. And then now Matthew, and I'm like, oh man, it's so good. So I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I just pray and hope that as a community, we're just steeped in it, we're just growing in it, you guys are reading it, and really enjoying. And again, if you've missed anything, we do record all these, and they're on YouTube if you like to watch something, but they're also on all the podcasts as well. And so as we see, especially in Matthew, Matthew's doing a brilliant job of tying all these stories together, and he's showing very thematic truths about Jesus. So even though today we're going to dive into a very specific story, it is in a bigger context of what Matthew is revealing to us about Christ. So I want to jump into it because this is such a good story. I mean, probably, has anyone not heard of this story before? Don't want to put you on the spot, but okay. It's a pretty famous story. Like, it's pretty well known, whether you've grown up in church or not. And combing through it and going through it like we're going to today, there's a lot of things that you can miss and little things that Matthew puts in there that really bring a powerful thing. And then we're going to look at it from kind of a big picture point of view to see what Matthew's doing. So you guys ready? Excited? Okay, three of you. We'll do this. It'll be great. So let's start with verse 18, okay? While he was saying these things to them, pause. What were the things he was saying to them? Again, this is one of those clues of like the words while he was saying. So this is linking back to what was just happening. These aren't just isolated stories. So what was he just saying? This is what we talked about last week. He's with his disciples. People are getting upset with him. The Pharisees are upset with him while he's eating with sinners and tax collectors. And then John the Baptist's disciples come over and say, why do your disciples not fast like we do? Why do they basically not look like what they're supposed to be doing in this time? And so he said things that were kind of wild in the moment. He'd say things like, well, it's because the bridegroom is here. And this is not a funeral. This is not something to be memorializing. This is like a wedding feast. And I'm showing his commitment to his bride, which is more his people. And so he's saying this is more of a ceremony. This is a celebration. And he's saying, I'm not just here to like patch up how things are going or to kind of make you feel better about what is happening in your religiosity, but I'm here to actually give you a whole new garment, something wholly new that you have to put on and actually put the old away. That something new now means that the old is no longer required. And then he said, I was like new wine that's being poured out, but if you're not changed, if you're not new, if I'm poured out into that, then it's going to expand. It's going to actually explode, and both will be ruined, the new wine and the wineskin. So if you remember that, he's basically just saying, I'm doing a new thing. This is all brand new. You can't fit me into the old paradigm. That's not what it's supposed to be. The old paradigm was supposed to prepare you for me, and then now I am here. And so this is the moment. The question was, were the people ready for it? Were their hearts prepared and in eager anticipation for God when he was on the move and when he would finally come to save his people? So there was a prophecy, an old prophecy from Isaiah. There's many passages that kind of say this, but this was well known. I want to read you some of the passages and I'll show you what the people would have thought of when the Messiah comes. These are the things that are going to happen. So I'm going to read you a few of these. Isaiah 26:19. Isaiah said, when the Messiah comes, your dead shall live. Their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy. And a little later, Isaiah 29, in that day the deaf shall hear the words of a book, and out of their gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind shall see. The meek shall obtain fresh joy in the Lord, and the poor among mankind shall exult in the Holy One of Israel. A little bit later, Isaiah 35, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. Then Isaiah 61, he kind of puts together what he's talking about. The one who is coming, this is what will be said of him. 61:1, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound. So we get this list. The list where when the Messiah comes, these are the things that are supposed to be happening. The blind would receive their sight. The lame could walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf would hear. The dead would be raised up. And the good news would be preached to the poor. Now, already at this point in Matthew's gospel, is this not what we've seen a little bit of from Jesus? These things should start being like puzzle pieces, putting back into place of saying, like, wait a second, he's doing the things that we believe the Messiah is to be doing. Jesus is revealing over and over again that he actually has the authority that has only ever been attributed to God and the Messiah that would come, the God himself. And yet here Jesus was doing the things that only God should be able to do. Remember in the paralytic story Gabe walked us through a few weeks ago, Jesus says, your sins are forgiven to the paralytic before he heals him physically. The Pharisees are upset with this. But do you remember what Jesus' response was? This is chapter 9, Matthew 9, verse 6. But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he then says to the paralytic, rise, pick up your bed, and go home. He's showing, with these miracles, he's showing the authority that he brings from heaven to earth. Some are starting to see this and believe, and their hearts are being changed, their minds are being changed, and some are still very skeptical. And the most skeptical are the religious leaders, especially the Pharisees, who are supposed to be leading the people in their daily living for God. And that's what makes this story start out so powerfully. Okay, so let's go back to verse 18. So while he was saying those things, while he was saying these things to them, behold, a ruler came in, knelt before him, saying, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her, and she will live. Powerful scene. Very important man kneels before Jesus and says, come, I'm desperate for you. Now, Matthew, as we'll see a lot of times, he kind of just cares about, like, what's the miracle? What's the thing that happens? But he doesn't really fill in a lot of the details. So the beauty of some of the other gospel accounts is we get to fill in some of the details here. So this is Mark 5:22, parallel to Matthew 9. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, if that's how you say it, and seeing him, he fell at his feet. Okay, so we know now his name, Jairus. Okay, this was this guy's name. He was one of the synagogue rulers. Okay, Matthew just says a ruler. This is a synagogue ruler, okay? So this is one of the guys who works closely with the Pharisees. He would work regularly with the same people who were seeking to undermine and to destroy Jesus whenever they could get a chance. Luke 8, parallel, tells us this. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house. So you put these together. Matthew says Jairus knelt before Jesus. Mark says he fell at his feet. And Luke says he implores Jesus as he's falling at his feet. As Jesus is teaching about doing a new thing, the synagogue ruler is so distraught. And unashamedly, he just runs through the crowd to fall at Jesus' feet and begs him to help. I don't know if this man just got fired. I don't know if at least he just showed his cards that at the end of the day, in his desperation, he truly believed that Jesus was his only hope and he would lose face for that. And we know his precious 12-year-old daughter had either already died or was at the point of death when Jairus had left to find Jesus. Interesting to note that many important people in the time, they would have errand boys or girls that would go and do their stuff for the messengers that would go. And usually someone like this would send someone, hey, go get Jesus, bring him here. Jairus goes himself. Like, there's this raw heart of the father here where he goes and he falls himself at the feet saying, I need you. I need you to come with me. Verse 19, and Jesus rose, which tells us right there, potentially, just seeing the language that he was down on the level with Jairus, which is pretty cool. Usually think of people falling at the feet and Jesus is there just kind of like, hey, you know, not domineering, but like, hey, how's it going? But he rose. He got down on Jairus's level. Jesus rose and followed him with his disciples. And behold, a woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. For she said to herself, if I only touch his garment, I will be made well. So Matthew starts off the story with this one major thing happening. This is what's going to happen. This is the main action. This girl is dying or possibly dead. This father is distraught. Jesus rises up and starts to go. And then there's this immediate interruption. Right? This immediate interruption with something totally different. Isn't that how things go with Jesus? Like the truth of Jesus is interruptible. Right? Jesus is not on a path where you can't interject. You have to wait till he's done. You have to wait till it's appropriate. Jesus is interruptible. Jesus, very arguably the most important man on the planet right now, with the most important job to do, is interruptible. Just lock that away as a godly character trait. Now, real quick, to understand this woman's situation, to understand the bleeding woman's situation, we need to go to all of our favorite books of Leviticus that we love, and know why this has been hard for her. What has happened? What has been laid out for her to live like? And remember, a lot of times we read this stuff and we're like, oh, thank God that Jesus, you know, freed us from that. But this stuff, it wasn't just to be cruel. These laws were to help society thrive. If you go and read the Old Testament, if there were no laws, if there were no purity laws, I think they would have died off very quickly, right? They did not have a lot going for them. And so these are actually mercy laws, but they sound kind of harsh. So this is Leviticus 15, 25 to 28. If a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her menstrual impurity, so this is an unnatural flow of blood. If she has a discharge beyond the time of her impurity, all the days of the discharge she shall continue in uncleanliness. As in the days of her impurity, she shall be unclean. Every bed on which she lies, all the days of her discharge shall be to her as the bed of her impurity. And everything on which she sits shall be unclean, as in the uncleanliness of her menstrual impurity. And whoever touches these things shall be unclean, and shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. But if she is cleansed of her discharge, she shall count for herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. Fun stuff. Right? This is an unnatural, a large amount of bleeding. And this poor woman has lived under this for 12 years, unstopping. Like something is unwell within her. And this woman who has suffered much had this kind of a rather irrational belief, it turned out beautiful, but belief nonetheless that if she could just barely touch Jesus's cloak, the fringe of his garment, not even his body, not his hands, not have him speak over her, but the bare minimum fringes of his garment, then maybe, just maybe, she'd be able to tap into the healing powers that she's heard about. She sneaks up behind him, reaches out, just barely grasping the edge of his clothes, no doubt hoping to go unnoticed. But the beautiful and terrifying reality of Jesus is that you can't be unnoticed by him. He will know you. He does see you. Verse 22, Jesus turned, and seeing her, he said, take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well. And instantly the woman was made well. I want to point out two incredible things that happen here. First is the healing. Your faith has made you well. She's made well. This woman has suffered so much. Matthew, again, doesn't tell us the emotions of the story, just focuses on the miracle. But if we go to Luke 5, 26, this woman who had suffered much under many physicians had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. Nothing could help her. Right? We aren't sure how, but she suffered probably very uncomfortably, very invasively by physicians who in the end couldn't do anything for her. In fact, Luke 8 tells us, Luke 8:43, though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. So think of this woman with Leviticus 15 hanging over her. She was completely broke. None of it amounted to anything. She had invested everything she had in hopes that someone could cure her. And yet for 12 years now, she's only gotten worse in her condition and then in her lifestyle. But now, what no one else could do, Jesus did. She was so desperate at the end of all her hopes, except she had heard that there was this man, this Jewish rabbi who was different. He wasn't keeping away from all the unclean, but was actually going to them and actually healing them. She might have even had friends, this is my own thoughts, but friends, because a lot of times the unclean would band together because that's the only people they could be with. Someone who they had a story of meeting Jesus and being healed and said, you got to go see him. You got to go. But here's a second incredible thing that Jesus did for her is what he calls her, daughter. Like, how long can you go on hearing you're unclean, you're not wanted before you start to believe it as your identity? Can you imagine the impact of being called daughter here? How long has this woman lived in squander and shame, disowned, unwanted, unclean? According to Leviticus 15, she was unclean and everything around her unclean as long as her bleeding continued. Much like the leper in chapter 8, if you remember this, this would have been an outcasting of the family, of friends, of community. Obviously, no romantic partner, no children. Right, this was a very lonely, isolated person. And I have no idea what it would feel like to have that kind of internal bleeding they've gotten used to for 12 years, but I imagine all the times that maybe it didn't happen, and she'd think, maybe this is that seven-day period where I can finally be clean again, and then it would start again. And just that over and over again disappointment. What would it have been like for her right then to be that identity, that horribleness she's lived with, to instantly be made well? What an incredible scene. It worked. Her faith worked. Jesus did what no one else could do. But there's the reality of what she just did to get to Jesus. She just committed an incredible injustice to her community. To know she was unclean and to willingly push her way through the crowd. Think about it. Everything and everyone she just touched was made unclean. She just created a wake behind her of shocked, probably outraged, and now ceremoniously unclean people, which was already bad enough, but it was to do the goal of the most unthinkable thing, to reach out, knowing she was unclean, to touch a rabbi. This was not done. If she touched this rabbi now certainly would have to miss synagogue, would be unclean before God, would be unable to celebrate Sabbath with their family or community. This was a thing you just did not do, but she does it. She just has to touch his cloak. And I imagine she does. The bleeding stops for her. It doesn't matter what's going on, who's yelling at her, who's maybe kicking her, who's mad at her, who's not caring. She was finally healed. Recognize she hasn't acknowledged Jesus as Lord. She hasn't said a prayer of salvation. She hasn't done anything religiously right. In fact, mostly wrong in the last few minutes. And yet there would have been such a moment of incredible and unbelievable worship for her right there. Jesus did for her what no one else could do. There was no one like him. And I'd be shocked if her eyes weren't full of tears with a big smile on her face. She looks up at Jesus, who stopped to turn and look at her, but maybe coming back to the reality of the moment, would he yell at her? Would he call for her to be arrested? Would he have her stoned for touching him, or at least cast away? But Jesus looks at her, and in this moment, instead calls her into intimacy as one of his own. A title she has most likely not heard in over a decade, daughter. This is actually the only time, if you read in your scriptures in Jesus' ministry, where he personally calls someone daughter. What a powerful identity to place over someone. To look down and not chastise, not be angry, but to say, you're actually one of me. You are mine. Now, one layer deeper than the obvious beauty to hear Jesus calling her into his greater family of God, think of this title in a Jewish context. To be a descendant of Abraham is to be an Israelite, but to be an accepted Israelite, a son or daughter of Abraham, is to be righteously clean or ceremoniously clean, not unclean. So beyond her shame, she also hasn't been an accepted real Israelite for over 12 years now, which also means there have been no hope to be part of the great covenant blessing between God and his acceptable offspring. That was the belief. So for Jesus to call her daughter here is bringing her back truly and fully into the great family of Abrahamic blessing, and for her to be reinstated as an Israelite once again, which is beautiful in its own. And I should mention, we aren't specifically told this woman was a Jew in the context of Matthew. I think there's a lot of contextual clues, but I should say there are some commentators who believe this to be a Gentile woman who pushed her way through, which maybe their argument was why she was able to break so many Jewish laws by her uncleanliness. But read it for yourself. If Jesus truly calls a Gentile woman daughter here, that would be an incredibly massive deal. For him to include a Gentile into that language, and we would be made much of, but it would also be really cool and much like Jesus does. Either way, this woman has been given her life back and would be able to live in community once again. So we have this interruption, this incredible scene of healing, and it just feels like you're kind of whiplash a little bit of like, wait, I thought we were going over here. So now back to, do you remember what Jesus, where he was going? Right, what his task originally was. He wasn't just casually strolling through town. He was supposed to be in a hurry, undistracted, to try and save this little girl who had either died or was dying. This was a major distraction. But God, in Jesus, is present with his people. Jesus, the man, didn't know necessarily who had touched him at first. The other gospel account said he looked around to see who had touched him. Looking around, and he knows that power went out of him, but Jesus, the God, was not partial to one healing over the other, because the kingdom of heaven is for all who accept it equally. And this is different than the culture that was set up, right? Closeness to God was for the most spiritual, the most religious, the most pious, but Jesus is showing a different way. He's showing the accepted, those who fall at the feet of Jesus. Now Jesus continues on his way, but to make the need for urgency even more painful, Luke 8:49 tells us this. While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." Like, what a scene here. If you're reading this, one daughter was just healed and reinstated, and another's daughter just died. The tension is palpable. What just happened? Like, Jesus, did you just fail? You wasted your time with this woman virtually no one knew or even wanted around, and now one of the most important people, a ruler of our town synagogue, his daughter died. If you would have just done your job, moved a little faster, had cared a little bit more, etc., right? Can you feel any of these emotions? Do you think Jairus felt any of these emotions? Right, he did seem to have faith. He says, "My daughter has died. Come and lay your hand on her to save her. But there would be sadness hearing this news again, disappointment, maybe just again a little bit of doubt of like, oh man, could this happen? It seemed like both of them fell at the feet of Jesus, and one was accepted and one was rejected. And that's what it seemed like. But back to Luke's account, Jesus actually turns to Jairus after this news and says, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." So let's pick it up in Matthew, verse 23. And when Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion. So when someone died, especially of an important family, they could hire professional mourners. Okay, this is an ancient practice in the days of Jesus. People would come, they'd play flute, they would mourn, they would wail, they would do all this kind of stuff, right? Well, as my mind wandered, I wondered, is there still something like that today? Like, is there anything that happens there? In some cultures, I saw that there were some, but I did find in a very, very shallow Google search an article from CBS News in March 2013 titled, "Rent a Mourner, supplies professional grievers for a price. Let me read this to you. Funerals are usually emotional events, but if you're worried that it won't have enough sad faces, there's a company that will help you make it sadder. The UK-based Rent-A-Mourner allows family members of the recently deceased to make sure their loved one parts ways in a packed house. For about $68 a person, discreet and professional grievers will offer 2 hours of crying. Now, no judgment if you want to go this route. I might actually put in a deposit just to be safe. But back in Jesus' day, it was not a weird practice and would designate the sadness of the moment of someone's grief. You go somewhere, and it wasn't just quiet and somber. It would be very public of like, this is something really sad and bad happened. So they finally get to the house, and already hearing the girl had died, they were affirmed at her passing by the funeral mourners that were there. But instead of putting his arm around Jairus and saying like, oh man, I'm really sorry, buddy, maybe next time, Jesus instead strides forward to the professional mourners, and he says, go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping. And their response betrays their authenticity. It says, and they laughed at him. If you're really, really, really sad, it's hard to go from wailing to laughing in a moment, right? So obviously this whole situation is a little bit rather ridiculous. Jesus is staring at professional mourners who were hired because someone had died, telling them that they are not necessary because this is not a funeral. Okay, actually connecting the idea of last week of the fasting before. Remember, everyone was mad at him for fasting. And he's saying, so far, these are situations you guys think are sad. You guys are thinking are about memorial or about there is no hope. And yet, Jesus has brought life to these situations. Like fasting was supposed to be a sign of mourning, these professional wailers were supposed to be a sign of death. But this is not so when Jesus is around. Verse 25, but when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went through all that district. Powerful. Again, there's that resurrection language. I put him in a row. The paralytic, when he was healed, he rose and went home. Matthew, when he was called to follow Jesus, he rose and followed him. And now the girl arose. There's this new life. Something new is happening. What was considered dead is now alive. Again, Matthew focuses on the miracle, but Luke gives some emotional details to the scene, Luke 8:54. But taking her by the hand, Jesus, he called saying, child, arise. And her spirit returned, and she got up at once, and he directed that something should be given her to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened. Like such a cool and powerful moment for Jesus and all those around him. We aren't told what happens after this, but you have to think that the synagogue ruler Jairus just had his life forever changed. Now, I want to take a second. I want to kind of step back. We've kind of been in the ground, in the weeds, looking at this stuff, but kind of take a 30,000-foot view up in the air, look at what's going on. There were two daughters in this story. First was Jairus's daughter, what should have been primary importance, and secondly was the woman who Jesus called daughter, of secondary importance. Now, in terms of God's family, is there any difference between the two girls in God's eyes? No, right? They're both his daughters. Jairus, like us, would want God to help his daughter first because it was the most important thing to him. But God saw two daughters in the story and knew exactly how to meet both of them on his own terms. Jesus is revealing what the people thought was of central importance and secondary importance might not reflect the actual heart of God. If you take away status, age, gender, wealthy or poor, and you just see created human, image bearer of God, then who is the priority? The answer should be no one. So there has to be trust that God will do what is good and right for each person in his own timing. And in this story, we're seeing once again how Jesus moved from what the people thought should be of central importance to the periphery and then back again seamlessly, right? He's not here to perpetuate or create a caste system. He's here to unify a one people. Jesus doesn't make a distinction of who's more important like society does, because the kingdom of heaven is for a different kind of human, right? The kind who have met Jesus and has been changed. Jesus is bringing the most important kingdom, but he's bringing it to the periphery or the outskirts and to the unwanted as much as he is bringing it to the central community. Now, there are a lot of takeaways from this passage today, but I think probably a false application, or at least an unhelpful one, would be that if we were just desperate enough for Jesus, then he should heal us of what we think is wrong with us. If we just try harder, reach out farther, desperately push everyone out of the way just so we can have that first touch. Because I don't think the point of these stories today is that Jesus heals. Think about all the hundreds of people who were touching Jesus, crowding around him, and at least we weren't told about it, but it doesn't seem like they were healed of anything. There's lots of people in the story that Jesus did not heal. And I just want to kind of pastorally take a second in this room. There's a lot of pain in this room. There's a lot of pain in our church of unhealing. I want to acknowledge that there are a lot of people in here that might have a hard time with a passage like this. Like, that's great that Jesus healed that little girl and that woman, but he didn't heal me. He didn't stop that bad thing from happening. He didn't save someone that I care deeply about. And that's very real. I believe Jesus grieves with you in that. I believe Jesus sees you and knows you in your pain. Jesus is the one who also suffered much so that he could be with you in your suffering. But that's why I'm convinced that this is not just a story about Jesus healing people. If our walk away was Jesus was just a healer and miracle worker, then we would relegate him to what we can get out of him so we can start living our best lives now, but not necessarily surrendering our lives to him fully. Interestingly, I want to get nerdy for a second. The same word for heal in the Greek in this story is the same word as save or rescue. So the Greek word is sozo. Sozo, and the Greek definition is to save, rescue, deliver, to heal. By extension, to be in right relationship with God, with the implication that the condition before salvation was one of grave danger or distress. Guys, in Jesus, healing is rescuing, and being rescued is healing. Right, Jairus, look at him, a leader in the synagogue, steeped in the law and the ways of religious leaders. When he was desperately in need of God, he didn't rely on the religious practices or pious behavior, but he ran and knelt before Jesus in great distress. He says to heal my daughter, but it was to save his daughter. The woman, the bleeding woman, unclean, rejected, isolated from any chance to be culturally close to God, utterly at the end of herself, pushed her way through social norms, knelt before Jesus to be rescued, to be delivered. This story is about Jesus as the great rescuer. The rescuer from the periphery to the central, from the outsider to the insider, from darkness to light, from death to life. And everyone in here today who has put their faith in Jesus has been saved from something and is still being rescued from something every single day. Jesus showed here that he is not bound by time and the limits that we are. Jesus did not waste time with the bleeding woman because he was not on a time clock for saving the little girl, because death is not a boundary to Jesus. So far, Jesus has healed many. He's cast out many demons, has already done much of what was thought of impossible, but now he's done the unthinkable and raised someone back from the dead. But again, as Matthew, if we take that big picture, what Matthew has been doing this whole chapter is about those who are deemed in society as good as dead. A paralyzed man, a tax collector, a perpetually unclean woman, and an actual dead girl. All these characters are vastly different in all their own story, but all share the quality of being considered dead, and yet Jesus and Jesus alone has brought them all back to life. See, Matthew is showing us the kingdom of heaven is found through nothing and no one other than Jesus Christ. Whether you're an important person in a society or an outcast in society, closeness with God can only be found through the person of Jesus. And all these people at one point had put their faith fully in Jesus, and it was Jesus who rescued them. See, he is fulfilling the Isaiah prophecy, fulfilling the role of the Messiah. What have we seen so far? Lepers are cleansed, the lame would walk, the dead would be raised up, and the good news is preached to the poor just like the bleeding woman in this story. Yes, he was healing, but more than that, he was rescuing, and he was showing a new kingdom for those who want to be rescued. Next week, we're going to walk through the blind receiving their sight and the mute being freed to speak and their powerful stories. But Hub City, Jesus has brought with him the full authority of the kingdom of heaven, the full power of rescue for anyone at any time who will fall at the feet of Jesus. Do we believe that? Do we believe he is still rescuing today? If you do, then that is the God we worship together today, tomorrow, and every day of our lives. Jesus is the God who rescues and saves, and that is the healing we need today and is a reality of God this morning.